Plenty on the radio today, from unpaid tolls and that solar eclipse to helping others overcome adversity. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
The Commission left out the testimony of 550 people. We are now missing a huge chunk of what should have had a bearing on the conclusions and recommendations of this commission. They are not there. That is serious.
And we call for anybody that knows anybody that has been affected by pyrite and mica to come and stand with us outside the convention centre, please.
That's when I realised that's what I'd been chasing my whole life. I wasn't chasing success, I was chasing that feeling to be worthy of love.
And we'll start here on the live line. Emma called Jo after some unpaid tolls gave her a rude awakening.
Yeah, this morning, 6:45, my doorbell rang, and I was presented with a tow-away truck and I would say maybe six big burly men handed me a letter and said, we're taking your car away, it's being seized.
So you heard the doorbell ring. You came, I don't know whether you were up already or you came down the stairs.
I'd love to say I was, yeah, but
okay,
no, I wasn't.
Don't worry. You came down the stairs and you saw
I woke up to my dog barking like crazy. Myself and my husband got up and came down. Just answered the door.
And what did you think? When you looked through the glass, what do you think was happening at a quarter to seven in the morning?
I just thought it was something happening on the road or maybe it was somebody. I didn't know, to be honest. I was half asleep. I didn't know, to be honest. And they just basically said, we want your key. We're taking your car. And we were kind of saying, well, why? You know, what's going on? I had no idea. No pre-warning. I didn't have any pre-warning, didn't know what was going on. And it was in my name, so I opened the letter and it just said toll bridges or NDA or the road authority or something like that. And like there was no, like, look, these lads were big, massive, you know, obviously my husband, you know, initially very angry and, you know, wanted to protect his family. Like, look, what are you going to do? Do you know what I mean? Like the truck was parked in the middle of the road. So which meant that if anybody was heading to work or whatever, you know, they knew that they were putting you under pressure.
Okay,
To get it sorted. We were told that the office wasn't open till 10 o'clock and that they didn't even have a figure of what was outstanding or what was, you know, why they were taking the car.
Just as a matter of interest, Emma, was your name on the court order? Your name as a female?
My name, yeah.
And it was clear. Yeah. Was there one female in that group of seven bailiffs?
No.
Well, what if they... But if someone knocks on a hall door at 6:45 in the morning and they're looking for a woman, who might be still in bed, might be stepping out of the shower, might be feeding a child or whatever... I would at least expect there'd be at least one woman at the door and say, are you okay? Can we talk to you now? Do you want to get dressed or whatever? You say there were seven men.
Yeah, I knocked into my neighbour next door who has CCTV and we could see at the end of the road there was four people outside and there was three people at the end, all men, all big lads. Okay. You know, there was no very...
And were they men and were they dressed in black?
Black, all in black. They'd no masks on at the door, as in face masks, nothing like that.
As in COVID, yeah. Okay, was your car gone?
My car is gone. So we had to wait 3 hours to ring the sheriff's office because they had no information at the door. Like, they kind of went, and I said to my husband, you know, is this real? You know, like... Like, really, it was a piece of paper. I sent it on to your team. It was like a piece of paper printed out, you know, that anybody could do. And I'm thinking, have we just given my car to anybody? I didn't know. Do you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Did they flash ID?
No. No, they didn't. Not that I remember, but to be honest, Joe, I was in shock.
In shock, okay.
So my husband
would
you'd
remember someone holding up an ID card saying, this is my name, this is who
I
work
think
for.
I would. Yeah, I think I would.
Now, you know what, I presume they'd say we had it on our arm or around her neck at that time.
I'd have to double check that, but I definitely didn't see an ID.
Okay, so you're in shock and your car is gone.
Yeah.
So you're waiting to ring the office.
Yeah. So I had to wait till 10 o'clock. Of course, you know, kids are getting up for school. Mm-hmm. You know, you're trying to be normal. And, you know, my eldest, she suffers with anxiety. She was actually hit by a car a couple of years ago. And she really, so I'm trying to hide that from her. Mm-hmm. You know, you're the whole thing, you're trying to keep everything as normal as possible.
Then Emma called the sheriff's office.
And I rang the sheriff's office this morning and I spoke to a guy called Con, I think.
Okay.
He said to me that there was a court order and that the amount outstanding was 8,100.
Wow.
Now, my car is a 141 Mazda. It's not worth 8,000. So I'm kind of going, what the hell? So, and then my next question was, well, what is it for?
Okay.
You know, like, what is this for? Yeah. I don't, you know, and he couldn't tell me what it was for. It was a court order and they're just dealing with it and that was it. So I said, look, I'll ring the solicitor. I rang Easy Trip first because I have my tag with Easy Trip.
Okay.
No, sorry. I rang the solicitor first and okay. The girl in the I said, look, what the hell is going on? I have a tag on my car. And she said there's 34 tolls from March to June, I think she said last year, mm-hmm. that weren't paid. OK, so in total, those tolls come to €100. Like if you were to pay them normally. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So look, I dropped the ball somewhere. But that was what they would have come, the value of them. So I said to the girl, look, this is obviously something has gone horribly wrong here. I have a tag on the car and whatever.
It does get you through at the minute, does it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I said, you know, and she said, well, look, it's gone too far now. There's nothing we can do. So I was getting no answers out of her either. So I rang Easy Trip, who I have my tag with, and I explained to the guy, I said, look, I only got the car last March. So, you know, it's not anything years ago. Do you know what I mean? It's right at the start of COVID. So I said to him, can you go back through my transactions? So in October, I was onto them because my card had expired and it wasn't going through. Obviously, the payments weren't going through.
Okay.
And I updated the card in the October. But when I was on the phone to Easy Trip in the October, I said to the girl, look, there's a couple of tolls outstanding on the car.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, they'll be backdated and they'll go through your account. So roughly around the same day, about €500 came out of my account from Easy Trip. So, now look.
But the bottom line is you owed 34 tolls at 290 piece, which came to 100 quid. But how did €100
morph into 8,000?
Into 8,000?
Yeah.
And this is a government agency, the National Roads Authority, the part of TFI Transport for Ireland. One is part that you don't get mixed up which is which at either side. But anyway, so did they say they tried to contact you or there was a court case? Or?
Yeah, like, look, I'm not saying, Joe, that I dropped the ball somewhere along the line here. There's something that's happened. I didn't get the court date. I've obviously missed the court date and they've gone straight to seizing goods. Look, I'm not saying, you know, that I'm not at fault here. What I'm saying is, how did €100 go to 8,000 to now they're cutting me a deal is what I was told today for 5,000 and I can get my car back. Like, you know, like we're both self-employed, so neither of us were working for the past year.
There's no way. 5,000 to get 5,000 and to pay someone else, you need to earn nearly 10,000 this country before tax.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this document. One thing that's obvious, they have your address, obviously.
Yeah.
Because they called to your address to take your car. So why didn't they? Did you get a letter in the last month saying we're coming to take your car?
No, never, no. The only thing I can think of, and this is, you know, obviously we're up since score seven this morning and I'm going through, there's apartments behind us, and if you put sat-nav into your phone and you come to my house, it brings you to the apartments behind us. So the only thing that I can think of, the plausible thing is that my post went there, or if somebody was dropping something off, that they put it there. But, I mean, they found me this morning, so I don't know. Yeah. Like, you know, obviously, I should have followed up on the tolls last October. The girl told me that they'd be backdated, and they were backdated, but they only went 90 days, is what I was told this morning. The guy in Easy Trip said to me this morning they only actually go back 90 days, and they recovered the tolls and any fees. That's what the €500 was for. So, obviously, we were in the middle of a pandemic. It wasn't the top of my priority. It's not an excuse.
And it's not coming across an excuse. What is coming across is this is bizarre that €100 in tolls. We've an awful lot of toll roads now in the country. There's no toll roads in Northern Ireland, as you know. There's one, I think, in the UK and a bridge. The tunnel is tolled. We've the East Link Bridge is tolled. We've the West Link Bridge is tolled. The East Link Bridge has been paid for 10 times over by the Dublin Family Motors, going back and forward because of the lunatic traffic, those lunatic down at the toll bridges as well. And this taxpayer has paid for the motorways time and time again. And the tolls go to private companies. But to go from €100 to €8,000 at the hands of a state agency.
It cost €2,000, they told me, to seize the car.
So it's this morning's operation with the Magnificent Seven men in black, plus the tow truck, plus they would have been working, they would have been called in early.
Yeah.
I presume 5 o'clock to be there. Your place is 6:45. That this morning's operation cost €2,000.
Apparently, yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's Emma on the live line with Joe Duffy. Now, there was a solar eclipse today and we were supposed to see it around 11 a.m. So Damien O'Reilly was talking to Francis McCarthy from Blackrock Castle Observatory in Cork. And now we know the real sound of disappointment.
How is it going, Francis? Oh, that doesn't sound good.
I'm sorry. We're here in Cork looking at rain. I'm peering out. I've got my telescope set up. I've stopped down the aperture because normally the telescope looks at things in the night sky and looking at the sun can overheat it. I'm all ready to go and I've got drizzle. I have seen a couple of shots from people in other parts of the country who are reporting heavy cloud, but gaps in it.
Right.
So we can keep our fingers crossed that we'll get a couple
If it was a clear sky, what should we be looking at?
Well, we should be looking at our gorgeous blue sky with a yellowy sun in it with a black part missing. So part of the sun should not be visible because the moon is in the way.
So it's like two coins and maybe you're pushing one in from a corner over the bigger one, is that
it? Or you've got the cookie and someone's eaten a bit out of it.
Right, the corner.
So it's a lovely look.
Yeah.
You know, it looks great, but of course you shouldn't look straight at it. It's recommended that you project the image, so look at the shadow of it on the ground. So grab something like a spoon with holes in it, you know, the big spoons that lift out the pasta, or your colander. And if you've got the sunshine, allow the sunshine to go through the colander. The shadow on the ground will show the shape of the sun.
All right, so do it that way because you don't want to damage your eyes if you're squinting up at the sun.
Yeah.
Where in the world would you like to be now watching this?
Well, if you could send me to Northern Ontario, I'd be delighted. Sault Ste. Marie is getting the best of the eclipse. This particular eclipse is known as an annular eclipse. It's a ring of the sun will still be visible even at the maximum. So when the moon is covering up as much as it can, it's still not going to completely cover the sun. And there'll be a little round ring of the sun. So this gets called this ring of fire eclipse.
Yeah. And is it any, regardless of you not being able to see it, are you feeling colder?
Well, this is it. I'm checking the weather stations. There's a couple of weather stations in around Cork Harbour. It is noted in the past that the temperature does drop a bit. Now, maximum eclipse is just around 11 o'clock for us. So that's the time you got to think. But, you know, it's raining, so it's a little hard to tell whether the temperature dropped because it started to rain or because I'm peering out trying to see if it looks a little bit darker.
Yeah.
But the clouds are not helping me.
Well, for once, Cork is not well ahead of the rest of the country.
It still is. It's just a tiny matter of a few clouds.
So this now, continues till what, 12 o'clock or so?
It continues to 12. So the end of the eclipse is 12. Now, this isn't a very deep eclipse from Ireland.
Okay.
Some of the sun will be covered up. It's a good one. There's a really good one coming up in 2026. So if you're willing to hang around for five more years, and there's one in 2022, there's another in 2024, there's one in 2025. I mean, they happen fairly regularly.
I might try and go to the Antarctic in December. There's one there then, is that right?
Oh, I know. So, yeah, like the Antarctic would be great.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure we'll be allowed to travel by then.
Well, Frances, we let you back to your job there, and hopefully the rain stops and you get a little peek at this once every four or five years phenomenon. And I'm sorry for you. I'd say you were waiting up all night and everything for this to happen.
I was so ready for this, and yeah.
Oh, it was a total eclipse of the heart for Frances McCarthy in Cork. But later on the News at One, Cillian Sherlock spoke to enthusiasts gathered at Astronomy Ireland in Ballycoolan in Dublin, where they were a bit luckier.
I wanted to see the partial eclipse in Ireland, the best that's been here for a long time, and we won't get a full one here till 2090, which I'm sure I won't be around. But I'd seen one in Turkey in 2006, which was great to see, so I'm hoping to see something that's good today. So, not on the same level, but the best we can see from here.
It's been years and years since I've seen a solar eclipse, so this is a big event for me. So I have my Canon camera all set up. It's starting now.
Can you tell me about this, the equipment you have here and what you're able to capture with it?
I have a Celestron, the Nexstar A, I have four, which is a 4-inch and the camera's a Sony, and it's attached to it. And you can pick up all the planets, some nebulas and things like that. It depends on how clear the night is and stuff like that. But
great. And how's it going today with the partial eclipse?
Very well. I can see it on the screen of the camera, so when it comes out, but it's pretty good.
How big of an event is this for you? That's
huge, yeah. You only see it every couple of times maybe in your life. But it's the first time I've seen this. Any time it's come out before, I haven't been able to see it because of clouds.
Ran to the car, put the dog in, and came up to get the special sunglasses.
Describe what you see for me, please.
So I'm seeing the sun there, and I'm seeing the start of a little bite on the very top of the sun, maybe a little more to the right, where the moon is crossing the sun. And it's very clear, just a little bit of cloud, very high cloud going over, but very visible. It's like a little bite out of the sun.
Well, the sunglasses black everything out except for the sun, which is a lovely glowing orange colour. And it's very clear, as in like the edge of the sun is very clear. And then there's a little chunk out of the top right hand side of the sun. So it kind of looks a bit like, I don't know, it's not quite a Pac-Man because it's not square. But I don't know, a piece of cheese with a bite out of it.
It's like the top is chopped off, the top of the sun. It's just like a little curve. Someone's have to take a spoon, chopping the top off it. And you can see a few little clouds passing over, but it's beautiful.
Cillian Sherlock's report from the News at One. And on Today with Damien O'Reilly, the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes.
Now, Katrina Crowe, who's historian and former head of special projects in the National Archives, has written an essay for the forthcoming issue of the Dublin Review. And it's an essay on the report of the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes, which was published earlier this year. And Katrina now joins me in studio. Katrina, good morning and thanks for coming along.
Good morning,
It's a very. I read your report of the report last night. It's quite intriguing. I suppose I'm going to begin by asking you to tell me about Caroline O'Connor's testimony versus what is recorded in the report, and that forms the preamble to your essay and to your analysis.
Mm-hmm. The reason first of all, I was incredibly lucky to have assistance from Caroline and from Noel Brown, who's another survivor. Mm-hmm. Both of them are willing to share with me very intimate details of their lives. And we must not forget that that is what survivors have to do in order to make the points that they need to make about how their testimony was disregarded in the report. Caroline's evidence, or her testimony, what, it's not evidence, obviously, mm-hmm. we've been told it's not, but her testimony, as you will know, Damien, from reading it last night, is very eloquent, very vivid.
She wrote her testimony down, yeah. and when she went in, she also herself recorded it.
She did. She still doesn't know why she did that, but she did.
Yeah, and then when she matched that against what was in the final report, that
is. Well, I did that.
You did that.
I mean, one of the things we have to remember as well is all of this is extremely traumatising for survivors. It was hard enough to live through what they lived through in the first place. They all went in good faith to this mm-hmm. commission to tell very difficult stories on the understanding that these were going to be treated respectfully and that they would be transcribed and put into an archive and a contribution to 20th century Irish history. So you can imagine they're just stress and re-traumatisation when they discover that is not what happened.
And in fairness, though, at the same time, though, they were treated on a personal level very well when they did give their testimony. Am I right in saying that?
Well, the ones that I've spoken to have differing opinions on that. Some say yes, very sympathetic hearings. Caroline said so. Others felt that they were not treated so well. So, I mean, everyone's going to be different. Part of the problem may be that the people who were conducting the interviews at the confidential committee didn't have any training in dealing with traumatised victims, which is an important part of doing any kind of stuff like this, and also didn't have any training in oral history, which would have given them a sense of how to approach these matters in a very professional sort of
okay,
way.
OK, we might come back to that a little bit later on, but just back once again to the discrepancies that you discovered in your investigation, and back to Caroline and to Noelle and indeed to Annette later, who you refer to in your essay as well. Explain, for example, how deep these discrepancies were.
Well, in the case of Caroline O'Connor, we have what amounts to about a 6-page vivid testimony, which she wrote down. She gave a copy of that to the commission and she read it out during the course of her session with them. She spent just over an hour speaking to the confidential committee. As you've just said, she had the brilliant inspiration to tape that herself. So I was able to listen to that tape and then identify Caroline in the confidential committee report, where everything is anonymized, so you don't get the details of what institution people were in or any allegations about any individuals. Fair enough. That would require them to be able to comment on it. So those 6 pages of vivid testimony, that hour-long discussion that she had with the confidential committee, is reduced to 2 paragraphs and 3 quotes. The 3 quotes allegedly come from her own words. 1 quote is accurate. 1 is entirely made up. It does not exist either in her own testimony or in the tape that was made. And the 3rd is botched. She's misquoted and it makes something very serious in her life sound grotesque in a way that it was not. So what does that tell us? It tells us that, yes, they made a tape. They told her they would make a tape. They'd never said nothing about destroying the tape, by the way, after the event, which is, of course, what happened. Did they listen to the tape when they were coming to the point of trying to reduce this material down into a size for their confidential committee? It would seem they didn't. They were taking notes. Were those notes impressionistic notes, or were they made by a stenographer who knew shorthand? I mean, we shouldn't have to go into all of this detail, but it's still a mystery how survivors could be so misquoted and misrepresented in the confidential committee, and primarily so reduced. 2 paragraphs from all of that wonderful information.
But like there were over 600 witnesses who gave evidence, a testimony of their experiences. So if you were to average them out at 6 pages each or an hour each, you couldn't obviously, you know, word for word put that all into a report. So what I'm wondering is the testimony in its collective, does it take from the actual thrust of the final report when you take all of the testimonies together, even if there are paragraphs here and quotes here and there? Do you think that it takes from the overall thrust and the final report?
Well,
and
the
what
fact
it says
is that the commission decided itself not to include it. This is the main issue here. This is the real problem. The commission, by the admission of Professor Mary Daly, who appeared at a seminar in Oxford last week, did not include the 550 testimonies to the Confidential Committee as part of their final report. And those testimonies did not inform their conclusions. That is critical here, because some of their conclusions were that there was no evidence of physical abuse in the mother and baby homes, no evidence of forced adoption, that the church and state were not the main perpetrators.
Yeah, it was family
abuse,
members
yes,
and
it was
fathers.
Family members and fathers, which goes against every idea of historiography we have for the 20th century.
They were complicit, but probably not the main
not the main drivers.
Yes.
I mean, where did families get these ideas from in the first place? But the point I'm trying to make is the commission left out the testimony of 550 people. There were 60 others who spoke to the investigative committee, which they did apparently take into account or say they did. We are now missing a huge chunk of what should have had a bearing on the conclusions and recommendations of this commission. They are not there. That is serious.
Historian Katrina Crowe from Today with Damien O'Reilly. Now, going out to a gig. Wow. The first Pilot concert in the Ivy Gardens in Dublin was happening in the evening, and Cian McCormack was reporting for the News at 1.
The smell of freshly cut grass. The buzz of electrical generators. The hustle and bustle of an outdoor pre-gig setup.
When we're beside our production office and the generator's going, it just brings you back to those lovely feelings of being stuck in a green field during the summer months.
Shay McNeillis of OnePlus Events is the event controller for the gig.
We're in the Ivy Gardens, right in the middle of the city. The sun is shining, I'm in my shorts. Haven't done this in quite a while, so I've missed all the festivals that we've generally worked on.
He describes what the Ivy Gardens looks like today. Now, the last time I was here at a gig, there were a couple of thousand people up at that end standing around. You're not going to have that tonight. It's 500 people. I can see you have ropes up, kind of designated areas, I think. Tell me how this works. Describe it to me.
Yeah, so everyone has to be socially distanced. It's a one-way system when people come in here. So there's 2 metres between each of the pods that we have. So the pods are broken into... There's four different types of pods. We have a pod of four. We have a pot of three, a pot of two, and a pot of one. It depends on how you booked your tickets. So they would have told us in advance they're coming in a pot of four. When they arrive, they get a wristband that tells them they're in a pot of four, and then they're brought into a specific size pod that fits that amount of people.
Tonight's James Vincent McMurrow concert in front of 500 people is the first of a series of live Pilot concerts. Shay McNeillis says it's important for the events industry.
And it actually is a quite a small community that we all know each other, with a lot of people working in it, but it's like a family, and it's great to be on a site here where you get to see, you know, the different guys from the production, the stage, the sound and light, musicians, the tour managers, security. We all know each other, and it's great to see people back working again, you know.
One of the first people you meet on the way into the Ivy Gardens is Sharon O'Neill, a manager with Integrity Security. She's delighted to be back to work.
We're ecstatic. It's great to get to see everybody. Do you know, it's great to be out. Everybody's just delighted to get back to work. Today is a really important day for everybody, not just security, to get back into live gigs and to get back to work, essentially.
Mert Whelan of Mert Whelan Sound from Limerick has 10 people working on the gig. He's had a hard year and hopes things can get better.
The pandemic has been really hard. It's been hard on us as a company. It's been hard for our freelancers. It's been hard for every company in our industry. But look, today is the start of new beginnings.
But what does it mean to you personally? Because there must have been fairly dark times over the last number of months where you were looking at equipment potentially in a storage room going, what am I going to do?
Yeah, last year was at the start of it. We didn't know where we were. The year previous, we had invested just over 1.8 million on new equipment, and it's all sitting in a warehouse. Today is the first day it's being used since the start of March last year. So that's a lot of equipment and a lot of money tied up. Thankfully, the banks have worked with us, but if we don't get back going fairly soon, we're going to be making some very difficult decisions. But I do believe we're getting to a positive place now where, you know, it's a bright future, and we have to look positive, and hopefully next year we'll be back to normal. But we may get a September, October out of it yet, hopefully.
Cian McCormick's report for the News at One. And in the morning, helping young people recognise and cope with struggles. Brothers Daryl and Cormac Noonan both faced mental health issues following different life paths and now use their experiences to help others on the road to feeling better about themselves. First up, Daryl spoke about a traumatic event that started his difficulties.
Well, you know, a big, huge turning point in my life was when I was 14. I was in a school bus crash where five girls died. And one of the girls I was extremely close to for a long period of time. Now, I fell out with her, actually, a few months before the crash.
Yeah.
And she was only sitting a couple of seats ahead of me, and five of the girls didn't survive, including my friend. And I didn't know how to take that at the time. I didn't know how to deal with that whatsoever. So I felt a lot of guilt, mainly for the fact that I was still alive, mm-hmm. when so many other people were obviously not, and then there was a lot of people were injured, and I was one of only two people that wasn't injured.
Oh, wow.
So I never wanted to complain. I never wanted to talk about it, because I just felt that I shouldn't. I should just be grateful for the fact that I'm still alive, which I was.
Yeah. I mean, people will remember it. It was May 2005. That's the Kentstown school bus tragedy. Quite a seminal moment in terms of school bus safety, because, if I remember, seatbelts and so on has become mandatory ever since then. But you were, as you say, you were one of the uninjured, one of only two people uninjured on the bus. Do you remember?
As far as I know,
do you remember much about that day, May 23rd?
Oh, I remember everything about that day. I remember the way most people walked onto the bus that morning, that evening. Just that day is very, very vivid still. And after that, that was the reason that was such a turning point for me, is I completely lost respect for life after that. I became very impulsive. I never would think of my consequences of anything, how it was affecting other people, how it was affecting myself, because I just got into a frame of mind that life could be taken so quickly that there was no point in waiting around for anything. And that's just the mindset that I developed after that, and it led me down a terribly destructive path for years, for nearly 15 years.
And Daryl, did it start immediately in the wake of that tragedy, or how did it unravel for you?
Well, after the tragedy, I held in all those negative emotions, all those negative thoughts that I was having. I held them in because, as I said, I didn't want to complain. And about a year later, I found alcohol.
You're 15.
Yeah, I was 15 and I found alcohol, and I couldn't believe how that made me feel. I could stop being that person, that negative, self-hating young kid, and I could just be this other person that I wanted to be. I created an avatar, basically, of someone that I wanted to be, and the alcohol could help me do that because it gave me more confidence to do this. And I got a huge love for it straight away. And that progressed. It was every weekend. But all those negative thoughts and emotions, they would come out when I was in my family home and when I was drunk. That would come out then, when I wasn't in front of other people, when I wasn't keeping that avatar going. And that would come out in anger and frustration. And it caused so many fights at home with my parents. I had three younger brothers. And it was hell for them. And I know it was. After that, then, it was after I finished school, my parents decided that they thought the best thing would be to send me away to Australia.
Right.
So I got a one-way ticket by myself to Australia. Now, I had a lot of resentment at the time for that, because I didn't see that they obviously had to look after the other three kids. You know, they had three younger brothers to think of, and I wouldn't take help. I didn't want help. I didn't think I needed it. I thought, like, you know, the alcohol, them parties, that was enough to keep me going, just being able to be that other person for that period of time.
Did it suppress the feelings that you had? Because obviously you had remorse somehow over the incident, because, as you say, you had been friends with one of the girls who sadly died. I mean, it was just a teenager tiff that obviously became such a huge thing, given that freak moment in 2005. You were just searching for oblivion, were you?
Yeah, I couldn't be in my own head. And all these incidences with the alcohol and stuff, that was just creating more and more self-hate for myself, and I suppressed all of it. And it was just a vicious cycle that I couldn't get out of, and it followed me to Australia. Like leaving Ireland, like leaving the environment, it can help at times to solve some problems, but yeah. All my problems were mostly in my head, and I just brought that everywhere I went. I travelled loads of different countries, bringing those problems everywhere, just constantly running away from them, never expressing, never talking about how I felt. I went to numerous counsellors as a young kid, but I never wanted to speak. I never wanted to be truthful. I just tell them what they wanted to hear. That's all I did at that age, because I just didn't want to be there. So I just tell them what they wanted to hear. I'd never say how I actually felt. And it got to a point, I was living in London for 5 years. This is well after Australia. And I was in a routine. I'd go to work during the day, gym, sleep. And I'd keep that routine for 4 or 5 days a week. But once I had any free time, and I mean 5 minutes, to sit with myself, I had to go get something. And I had found drugs at this stage as well, so it was the two. And I wouldn't be able to sit with myself for 5 minutes with my own thoughts. And that, wow. I didn't do that. I didn't sit with myself for 5 minutes for, like I said, well over 10 years. Never actually sitting there with my own thoughts, seeing how I felt. I had to be this other person. I had to be this avatar all the time. It was the only thing that was keeping me going at that stage, because none of my emotions, none of my negative thoughts had ever been able to come out. So I couldn't even think of sitting with them.
So Daryl described the turning point for him.
The breaking point the first time was waking up in hospital attached to a load of tubes. I'd actually went to get on an airplane in England, and I woke up in a hospital in Dublin. I didn't even know where I was. And that was the first time that I was like, okay, I need to go get treatment. Mm-hmm. So I did, but I didn't last. I went in 2 times in that year, but I was only doing it to keep people off my back. I thought I'd hit my rock bottom, but I was far from it still.
Yeah.
Because I still didn't know. I still didn't know how important it would be to say how I felt. I still was very embarrassed about how I felt. Nobody had told me, like, just to maybe just start opening up and it might start helping, you know. And maybe people did tell me, but I just wasn't ready to listen.
There was an incident involving a bottle bank, which really was the sort of, that was the changer, wasn't it?
Yes. So when I came out of treatment, those 2 times I went in, I went back to that life I was living in London, just partying all the time. And it was getting to a point, though, it progressively got very worse, and I would spend up to 7 days in a room by myself, just drinking. I'd leave the room just to go to the off-license, and I would just sit in that room wallowing in my own misery for days and days, and I just couldn't pull myself out of it. And that incident you're talking about, that was the rock bottom. I woke up one morning and I reached around like I always did, just reaching around, seeing if there was an empty, like a half a bottle of vodka that I could throw down just to calm the thoughts that were in my head. But there wasn't at this time. And it was still too early for the off-license to be open. So I just got this thought in my head that I was like, when people drink at home, they always leave a little bit in the end of their wine bottle, in the end of their vodka bottle, in the end of their beer can, whatever it is. And I thought if I went to a bottle bank where all the recycling was, that I might be able to drink enough of that just to calm myself down until there was a shop open. And I did that. And I went through every single thing that was in that bin. Wow. Every single thing. And what really struck me when I came out of this episode, it went on for well over a week, was that when I was sitting there after, I wasn't actually thinking how messed up the situation was. I was just thinking, how did I never think of doing this before when I've been in this pickle, you know?
Wow. The drinker, the alcoholic in you thought this was a clever idea, that you were going to go to the bottle bank. In that moment where you're grappling around at essentially a rubbish tip looking for alcohol, I mean, that's an incredible effort to escape your own thoughts, isn't it?
I would do anything. It got, like, anything that would alter my state of mind. I could not sit with myself.
Well, that's Daryl's story. Then Brother Cormac told his own story.
I suppose my story was a lot different to Daryl's. I suffered with, like, really low confidence when I was in my teenage years. And then after, I was really focused on my studies, and I thought if I achieve things and do well and get that really good job, maybe people will like me. And I only realized this now, looking back. I was coming from a place of a lack of self-love for myself. And I thought if I achieve things, the world will love me or other people will love me, because I just never felt that I was good enough as I was. So I went and studied in Trinity and got the job I thought I always wanted in IT. And I realised I didn't feel any different. I didn't feel successful that I thought once I get this stuff, I'll feel better about myself.
Okay.
And that, for me, that was the point where I realised I'd just been listening to everyone else's opinions of what I should do, of society's opinions or of what was success. And I realised that I was actually miserable in the job and I didn't feel any different. I still felt the exact same.
Do you think you were kind of hooked on, you know, ticking those boxes of achievements, to use them, what society says are achievements, including exams? It was exam results and so on like that for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was very focused, like doing my Leaving Cert, and I did well in the Leaving Cert and got into Trinity. So everyone was like, oh, that's a great college to get into. And yeah, it was... I think it was really, there was just a hole that I felt I was trying to fill because I didn't love myself enough. And I was trying to fill that with achievements. Mm. Whereas Daryl might have tried to fill that with alcohol or drugs. But
yeah,
it was really the same root problem, that we just didn't love ourselves enough, in my opinion.
Were you kind of obsessive about the achievement? Like, was your focus, which is obviously a good thing to be focused on exams if that's what you want to do, was it detrimental to your head?
I was actually... fairly well balanced. I was playing football and stuff as well, so it was quite sporty and mm-hmm. had plenty of mates, and I was very focused on the studies. But I think it only became detrimental when I got to that job and I was sitting in that office and I just realized I've been building up to this, like 4 years in college and all that study, and I'm here now and I hate it, and I was like, where do I go now? So wow. I kind of just felt this sense of like being lost. And that's when I decided to quit then after. Well, I still did for a couple of years because it was hard to quit because it was so comfortable and it just didn't make sense.
I suppose everyone's telling you, why are you going to quit this good job?
Because it didn't make logical sense to quit, but I just had to listen to my heart. It just didn't feel right. So I decided to quit and go traveling and discover who I actually was, because I think that's why I didn't know what I wanted, because I didn't know who I was and I never learned about myself in school or anything like that.
Now, people talk about, because you have everything on the textbook success. You've come out, you've done a great Leaving Cert, you've got the Trinity degree, you've got a big job in the big company, but you just weren't happy. And a lot of people talk about, I'm going traveling to find myself. Did you find yourself?
Yeah, I think I kind of don't really like that phrase either, but it is true in some sense.
Because it's rarely true, is it? When people say, I'm going to find myself, really it's...
It was more just... one of my mates, Teen, says you create yourself, you don't find yourself. So it was kind of going to partly discover the things I truly wanted to do and also create the person I wanted to become based on like the character traits I looked up to in other people. And I wanted to be, say, more honest or more open and more determined, whatever it was. It's like, how can I create that person I want to be and not just what society says you should be? So it gave them a couple of years away from Ireland and away from all the opinions of everyone around me, just really gave me the time to get to know myself and get to develop that character more. And then at the end of my travels, I went on a cycle for 30 days alone because I wanted to...
In Canada,
yeah.
Gosh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was a tough experience at times. There was plenty of low moments as well. But as Daryl said there, he couldn't sit with himself. But I wanted to force myself to sit with my thoughts because I knew there was answers in there.
Is that why you say you had low moments on that trip? Because that sounds like a dream trip. So you weren't entirely happy, but you sat with yourself, as you say.
Yeah, so about 2 weeks into the cycle, I was by myself. I just had a tent on the back of my bike and I didn't have much money. I just had enough for food. And then I remember 2 weeks in, I hadn't slept well for a couple of days. I was at the bottom of this mountain and I was tired, I was hungry, and I just got this wave of loneliness. I was missing my family, my brothers back home, and the people I loved. And I just realised that the most important thing in my life was love. And I didn't care about any jobs or anything I was going to do in the future. All I wanted was to see the people I still loved.
Yeah.
And that's when I realised that's what I'd been chasing my whole life. I wasn't chasing success, I was chasing that feeling. Mm-hmm. To be worthy of love. And that's something that I don't think we talk about as men, especially me.
Then Oliver asked Daryl about getting together with Cormac to help other young people with their experiences.
Well, I rang Cormac then when I got this brainwave to go around to the schools spreading awareness. I wanted to do talks. And Cormac had the same idea without even speaking. He was still, I think he was just coming back from traveling, and he had the same idea.
Very good.
And so then we decided to join forces and start doing it together, and it's just grown from there.
And the key to it is talking about your own experience, isn't it, Cormac?
Yeah, we don't want to be too preachy to the students, telling them what they should do and what they shouldn't do. We just share our experiences and what paths we went down, and then what helped us get over that. Like, as Dara said, the tools and techniques that we used, and if it's up to them, then if they want to use those as well. So we feel that when we do go in and talk to students, they do connect with us because we're telling their honest stories, and we're not, you know, telling them what they should do and shouldn't do, which they're probably fed up hearing. So we believe that each young person has unique potential within them to do whatever they want to do. And it's in discovering who they are first that they'll figure out what it is they want to do. And also, as Dara said, his message is on expressing yourself and not bottling those things up. And my message is mainly to listen to your intuition and let it guide you in what you really want to do.
I mean, you go into schools and it's kind of good because you've got every angle covered, don't you? Because Daryl obviously has the very very obvious signs of addiction that some young people might show in terms of drink and drugs, whereas you have the kind of stuff where you think someone has it all, is perfect. What do you say to, teenagers if they're listening and looking at you? Maybe, you know, they're going to be cynical at that age and they think, sure, everything's grand here. So how do you register with them and strike that chord?
If I did have to give advice, it would just be from my perspective. If I was giving advice to my teenage self, I'd say don't be so hard on yourself and don't think you have to achieve anything to be worthy of something. You don't have to achieve anything. You don't have to be anyone. Just be happy with who you are and try and learn about yourself and get to know yourself, and then you can start to love yourself more, because you can't really love someone you don't know. So get to know yourself first and just do it with compassion. That's what I'd say.
And Daryl, in terms of the problems that people have, if they need it and they're youngster, what's there for them?
Well, what I would say is just to talk to someone. It can be anyone. And no matter how stupid you think it might sound, just find that one person or that couple of solid mates that you can confide in. And it can even, because a lot of people would still be very nervous about speaking out about how they feel about certain things. And I found journaling. So getting a notebook specifically for journaling your thoughts down, and it just gets them out, and it stops them from manifesting and becoming something that they don't need to be. Do you know, I know that would have helped me when I was younger. So if anyone is listening to that was, it's a key thing that I still do to this day. My journey is far from over. This is a daily thing. It's a lifelong journey, and you just need to keep these healthy habits, healthy routines, and they make each day better, which in turn makes your life better.
Daryl and Cormac Noonan talking to Oliver Cannon in the morning. Now it's everyone's nightmare, the home you saved so hard to buy and you find it's inherently flawed. Barry Lenehan was looking at the issue of mica and pyrite in houses when he was talking to Damien O'Reilly in the morning.
Yeah, good morning, Damien. From the banks of the River Moy, that's where I'm talking to you from at the moment. The Jack Charlton mural and memorial just across from me, put him under pressure, as he'd say. And that's what the opposition is hoping to do next Tuesday, when thousands of people from Donegal and Mayo descend on Dublin's Convention Centre, where the Dáil is sitting. And it's understood Sinn Féin will use its private members' time next Tuesday to table a motion calling for 100% redress for homeowners affected by mica and pyrite. Party sources say the motion should be finalised by tomorrow morning. Now, the current scheme, as we know, offers 90% compensation, if even, say, campaigners. And with two government TDs in Donegal and three here in Mayo, their votes will be closely watched on that motion next week. But here in Ballina, 8 different housing estates around the town are reporting pyrite-related damage, and more people are coming forward all the time. The North Mayo Pyrite Action Group reported less than 200 homes affected at the start of the year, now more than 900. Barbara Clinton is a group administrator. Her home in Killala shows severe cracks both inside and out, and she appraised me of the situation here in Mayo.
We all buried our heads in the sand here for years, and it was muted here in our estate in Killala that pyrite was an issue, and it wasn't until one person went for a test, came back positive, and a second and a third, that more people are coming from it for testing for pyrite. There's a shame that if you have a house with pyrite, and it shouldn't be, because none of this is of our making. We bought our homes in good faith.
Another element here is the housing supply, in particular around Ballina.
I don't know where anybody is going to live, because I think there was only two houses available for rent in Ballina in the last recent weeks. If there's hundreds of us that are affected and have to demolish our homes, I don't know where we're going to live. We're effectively homeless.
The government argues it should be given time, that the Minister Dara O'Brien has engaged with stakeholders like yourself.
But there are houses around here that are not fit to live in. I heard Leo Varadka say that this can't come out of the Exchequer. Well, we have put into the bloody Exchequer, and yet we're being penalised because of the failures of the government not to monitor the regulations for quarries to build Weetabix blocks. We will stand with Donegal Mica Group for 100% redress outside the convention centre, and we call for anybody that knows anybody that has been affected by pyrite and mica to come and stand with us outside the convention centre. Please, we need your support badly. We can't do this on our own. Our homes are falling apart. Our lives are falling apart. Every waking minute is consumed with pyrite.
Barbara Clinton there, and Barry spoke about how widespread the issue is.
So unlike pyrite problems in Dublin and Leinster, the issues here involve blocks rather than ground fill. Hence, Mayo homeowners are pooled in with those in Donegal seeking help from the same redress scheme. But also the pyrite problems here are more difficult to fix as a result. And Mayo County Council tells me this morning how of the 93 applications for redress it has received to date, 67 homes require full demolition. It's estimated over 1,000 homes in the county are affected. Urban estates in Ballina, rural areas too around Erris, and while many are only reporting cracks in recent months, others have been dealing with this for several years. Problems first emerged at Dennis O'Boyle's family home in Kilfine in 2007. It's now in serious disrepair as he tapes his windows shut to keep his wife and two children warm. His current repair bill stands at around 80,000.
Large cracks throughout the house. Parts of the reveals on the windows are starting to fall off. The top gable has moved out about an inch either side. The house is spreading either way. Each gable is moving. The house is being distorted all the time. Every year that goes by, it just gets worse and worse, and it's going to come to the stage where it will start falling, like, you know, and that's our biggest worry, is because we don't have anyplace else to go, like, you know, this is our home.
Gable wall there, like a spider's web. What about the corner of the house here?
The cracks are really, really bad. Blocks there you can see is actually where the quarry themselves that provided the blocks to us came about 7 or 8 years ago. We were on to them about the problem, and they came and they took a sample for testing, but after numerous attempts to get the results, they wouldn't give us the results. I'd been into the quarry several times, and they just kept putting me off and putting me off.
Dennis, we're at the front of the house here, and look at that, the size of that crack. Can you fit your hand in that, could you?
Yeah, well, I can fit my fingers, like we say, down and at the top of there, and there's the guts of an inch there in between the cracks, like, you know, so it's just getting worse and worse. It's not going to get any better. It's very disheartening, like, you know, when you build a house and you find out that the house is worthless. It's like a jigsaw. You could nearly take a piece out and put it back in again, like, you know, and especially there around the window where you can see that the gable end has come away from the window by over near, well, it's, you know, 3/4 of an inch. Like the chances there, like, if it goes on for a few years, this house is going to fall.
So this is the living room, Dennis. What are we looking at here?
In this room here now, we've got just, you can see where the windows, we have to tape the windows because otherwise it is impossible to heat the house on bad nights. The drafts in the windows where they've been distorted and that, like, you know. So you can see yourself there now where the tape, we have the tape put around the windows.
You're telling me you're taping your windows to your own house?
Basically, you wouldn't be able to heat the house otherwise. Like, you're living in a draft and bare, the taping of the windows, like, we never heat the house. It cost a fortune. And all of a sudden now they're telling me that I have to pay 10%, not alone 10%, but I have to pay for my own storage. I have to pay rent if I have to move out. All that was covered in the east of the country and one or two other counties, and they got 100%. Why is Mayo and Donegal so different? We should be treated the same as the east of the country. Like, we're all Irish citizens.
Dennis O'Boyle from Barry Lenehan's report in the morning. Now, it wouldn't be too surprising to hear that people drank more alcohol during the lockdown. For Morning Ireland, here's Nikki Jordan, manager of TRUS, a community addiction service in Dundalk.
So we've seen a marked increase in the number of people unable to get into a residential treatment centre. And I don't know, is that because during COVID a lot of places were closed or had a minimum number of beds? But there definitely has been, we have been calling places, helping people, trying to get people to ring themselves every day to try to get in somewhere. We've had people that we've just been supporting on a weekly basis, just linking in with them until they do get a bed in a service.
How important is it that when someone says to you that they are ready to access the services, that they can do it, that they are accessible?
Well, I actually think, to be honest, with addiction, it's vital. Because for some people, they just get a moment of clarity, you know, a moment of motivation, and they just say, I can't do this anymore. And then when they don't get the help that they need, and they maybe get a knockback and they're not able to get in, then, you know, it just continues again for another while until they get another amount of motivation to do something about it. And for a lot of people, it's, you know, life spirals out of control.
Nikki Jordan there. Then Mary Wilson spoke to Joe Barry, public health doctor and board member of Alcohol Action Ireland.
We know we have this problem with alcohol, but what is the difference, or what is the gap right now between the services that are on offer and the number of people you have who are seeking treatment?
I think the issue is sheer scale of the problem, Mary. It's no secret that we have issues with alcohol in this country. And this particular report is looking at people who are alcohol dependent, who really need in-depth help. And it's estimated by the Health Research Board that that's up to 250,000 people, a quarter of a million. And about half of these people are parents of children. So there is not enough service provision at the moment. The HSE has about €160 million to spend on drug and alcohol services each year. Now, I think the illicit drug services take up the majority of that funding. And what we're doing in Alcohol Action Ireland is trying to shine a light on the gaps that are there. It's not blaming anybody, we're just saying there are major gaps, and our fellow citizens, lots of them, would do much better if there was a more widespread service provision across the country. And as Nikki said there, it's crucial. You're looking to try and be ready for people when they are ready, you know, to seek help. Not everybody who is alcohol dependent is ready to stop or may wish to stop, but very many more would do if it were available.
Joe Barry for Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.